generations of historians and biographers. What we do know is based primarily on two letters Washington wrote to Sally in September 1758 while serving in the Forbes campaign, and one letter he wrote near the end of his life in an uncharacteristically sentimental mood. In the latter, he confessed to an elderly Sally that she had been the passion of his youth, that he had never been able to forget her, nor been able to eradicate from my mind those happy moments, the happiest in my life, which I have enjoyed in your company. The earlier letters of 1758 are convoluted documents, in part because the act of writing them threw Washington into such emotional disarray that his grammar and syntax lost their customary coherence, in part because he deliberately used imprecise and elliptical language to prevent any prying eyes from knowing his secret. Here are the most salient passages. "'Tis true, I profess myself a votary to love. I acknowledge that a lady is in the case, and further, I confess that this lady is known to you. Yes, madam, as well as she is to one who is too sensible of her charms to deny the power, whose influence he feels and must ever submit to. I feel the force of her amiable beauties in the recollection of a thousand tender passages that I could wish to obliterate, till I am bid to revive them. But experience, alas, sadly reminds me how impossible this is, and evinces an opinion which I have long entertained, that there is a destiny which has the sovereign control of our actions, not to be resisted by the strongest efforts of human nature. The world has no business to know the object of my love, declared in this manner to you, when I want to conceal it. One thing, above all things in this world I wish to know, and only one person of your acquaintance can solve me that, or guess my meaning. But adieu to this till happier times, if I shall ever see them. Do we still misunderstand the true meaning of each other's letters? I think it must appear so, though I would fain hope the contrary, as I cannot speak plainer without. But I'll say no more, and leave you to guess the rest. I should think my time more agreeably spent, believe me, in playing a part in Cato with the company you mention, and myself doubly happy in being the Juba to such a Marcia as you must make." In Joseph Addison's Cato, 1713, Marcia is the daughter of Cato, and Juba is the prince of Numidia, who is required to conceal his secret love for her. Only someone dedicated to denying the full import of this evidence could reject the conclusion that Washington was passionately in love with Sally Fairfax. The titillating consummation question is almost as irrelevant as it is unanswerable. The more important and less ambiguous fact is that Washington possessed a deep-seated capacity to feel powerful emotions. Some models of self-control are able to achieve their serenity easily, because the soul fires never burned brightly to begin with. Washington became the most notorious model of self-control in all of American history, the original Marble Man. But he achieved this posture, and sometimes it was a posture, the same hard-earned way he learned soldiering, by direct experience with difficulty. Unlike Thomas Jefferson, he wrote no lyrical tribute to the interior struggle entitled Dialogue Between the Head and Heart, but he lived that dialogue in a primal place deep within himself. Appearances aside, he was an intensely passionate man, whose powers of self-control eventually became massive because of the interior urges they were required to master. Nothing was more inherently chaotic or placed a higher premium on self-control than a battle. He had played a leading role in four of them. One, a massacre that he oversaw. The other, a massacre that he survived. One, an embarrassing defeat. The other, a hollow victory. Whether it was a miracle, destiny, or sheer luck, he had emerged from these traumatic experiences unscathed and with his reputation each time higher than before. He had shown himself to be physically brave, impetuously so at Fort Necessity, and personally proud, irrationally so in the Forbes campaign. His courage, his composure, and his self-control were all of a piece, having developed within that highly lethal environment that was the Ohio country, where internal shields provided the only defense against dangers that came at you from multiple angles. One of the reasons he proved clumsy and ineffectual at playing the patronage game with British officials was that deference did not come naturally to him, since it meant surrendering control to a purported superior, trusting his fate and future to someone else. Though capable of obeying orders, he was much better at giving them. Though fully aware of the layered aristocratic matrix ruled by privileged superiors in Williamsburg and London, he was instinctively disposed to regard himself as better than his betters. The refusal of the British Army to grant him a regular commission did not strike him as a statement of his own unworthiness, but rather a confession of their ignorance. His only experience of complete control was the Virginia Regiment, and, no surprise to him, it was his only unqualified success. If we are looking for emergent patterns of behavior, then the combination of bottomless ambition and the near obsession with self-control leaps out. What will in later years be regarded as an arrogant aloofness began in his young manhood as a wholly protective urge to establish space around himself that bullets, insults, and criticism could never penetrate. Because he lacked both the presumptive superiority of a British aristocrat and the economic resources of a Tidewater grandee, Washington could only rely on the hard core of his own merit, his only real asset, which had to be protected by posting multiple sentries at all the vulnerable points. Because he could not afford to fail, he could not afford to trust. For the rest of his life, all arguments based on the principle of mutual trust, devoid of mutual interest, struck him as sentimental nonsense. A few other abiding features were also already locked in place. He combined personal probity with a demonstrable flair for dramatic action whenever opportunity, be it a war or a wealthy widow, presented itself. He took what history offered, and was always poised to ride the available wave in destiny's direction. Speaking of direction, he looked west to the land beyond the Alleghenies as the great prize worth fighting for. And although he did not know it at the time, the rewards he received for his soldiering in the form of land grants in the Ohio country would become the lifetime foundation of his personal wealth. Though he was still developing, the sharp edges of his ambitions were inadequately concealed, his sense of honor was too anxious to declare its purity, the outline of Washington's mature personality was already assuming a discernible shape. When he resigned his commission in December 1758, the officers of the regiment composed a touching tribute, lamenting The loss of such an excellent commander, such a sincere friend, and so affable a companion. Washington responded in kind, observing that their final salute will constitute the greatest happiness of my life and afford in my latest hour the most pleasing reflections. The regiment had been his extended family for more than 3 years. But now he was moving on to Mount Vernon to establish a more proper family, over which he intended to exercise equivalent control. Whatever he felt towards Sally Fairfax, she was a forbidden temptation who could not be made to fit into the domestic picture he had formed in his head. Memories of her had to therefore be safely buried deep in his heart, where they could not interfere with his careful management of his ascending prospects. Whatever he felt toward Martha Dandridge Custis, she did fit. Indeed, fit perfectly. They were married on January 6, 1759. Writing from Mount Vernon later that spring, he described his new vision. "I have quit a military life, and shortly shall be fixed at this place with an agreeable partner, and then shall be able to conduct my own business with more punctuality than heretofore, as it will pass under my own immediate supervision." Chapter 2. The Strenuous Squire. Over the course of his long public career, Washington made several decisions that shaped the basic contours of American history. But nothing he ever did had a greater influence on the shape of his own life than the decision to marry Martha Dandridge Custis. Her huge dowry immediately catapulted Washington into the top tier of Virginia's planter class and established the economic foundation for his second career as the master of Mount Vernon. His first career as a professional soldier still hovered about his reputation in the form of the title Colonel Washington. And it apparently still hovered about in his own head as well, since in 1759 he ordered 4 large busts of military heroes, Alexander the Great, Julius Caesar, Charles XII of Sweden, and Frederick the Great, to decorate the mansion he was already in the process of enlarging. The invoice to his London agent requesting the busts included requests for kid gloves, negligee, a velvet cape, and several purgatives for intestinal disorders. The agent was able to find all the other items, but not the military busts. This was prophetic, because for the next 16 years Washington devoted his energies to perfecting the elegant lifestyle of a Virginia aristocrat, making his military experiences into memories, but eventually worrying himself sick that he and his fellow Virginia grandees were trapped in an imperial network designed to reduce them all to bankruptcy and ruin. Domesticities. He was entering what turned out to be the most settled period of his life. The physical centerpiece for this newfound stability was, of course, Mount Vernon, both the mansion itself and the lands surrounding it. Renovations in the mansion had proceeded apace during his absence in the Forbes campaign, effectively adding a full story to the home he had inherited from Lawrence, or more accurately from Lawrence's widow, who died in 1761. Though not in the same league with brick mansions like the Fairfax's Belvoir or Thomas Jefferson's Monticello, the enlarged and embellished interiors of the new Mount Vernon were designed to make a statement. The home, now visited by more than 1 million tourists a year, looks different than the home that the newly married couple inhabited in 1759. the distinctive cupola, piazza, and several of the grandest rooms were not added until later. But Mount Vernon still effectively announced the arrival of an impressive new member of Virginia's elite. Passing through in the summer of 1760, the inveterate English traveler Andrew Burnaby was suitably impressed. "This place is the property of Colonel Washington, and truly deserving of its owner. The house is most beautifully situated upon a very high hill on the banks of the Potomac, and commands a noble prospect of water, of cliffs, of woods and plantations." Burnaby spoke of plantations in the plural, because Mount Vernon, like most Virginia estates in the Revolutionary era, was not a centralized agrarian factory like the cotton plantations of the antebellum South, but a series of loosely connected farms, each with its own distinctive name, slave workforce, and overseer. Between the time he moved in with Martha and the time he departed for the war against Great Britain in 1775, Washington more than doubled the size of Mount Vernon, from about 3,000 to 6,500 acres, chiefly by buying up adjoining parcels of land when they became available. He more than doubled the size of the slave population, from fewer than 50 to well over 100, much of the increase coming from the 46 new slaves he purchased during this time. Although appearances turned out to be deceptive, the newly ensconced master of Mount Vernon appeared to hold sway over a burgeoning and flourishing enterprise. The emotional centerpiece of Washington's new world was Martha, who came complete with two young children, Jackie, 4, and Patsy, 2. If the main source of Martha's appeal was initially more economic than romantic, there is reason to believe that the relationship soon developed into an intimate and mutually affectionate bond of considerable affinity. We cannot know for sure. Matters of this sort can seldom be known for sure, because Martha destroyed their private correspondence soon after her husband's death. Only 3 letters between them survive, compared to over 1,000 between John and Abigail Adams, the most fully revealed marriage of the age. But later efforts to suggest that Washington's marriage lacked passion, and that the slogan, "George Washington slept here," had promiscuous implications, have all been discredited by most scholars. The fact that they had no children of their own is almost certainly not a sign that they were sexually incompatible, but rather that Washington himself was most probably sterile. Although these are not the kind of questions we can answer conclusively, and it is possible that Martha lost the capacity to conceive after delivering her last child, it is more likely that the man who would become known as the father of his country was biologically incapable of producing children of his own. As for the suppressed feelings for Sally Fairfax, all the evidence indicates that everyone behaved themselves. Sally and George William Fairfax were the closest neighbors and became good friends of George and Martha, the most frequent guests at Mount Vernon, intimate accomplices in the hurly-burly of the ambitiously genteel social life within the Northern Neck. It seems likely that both Martha and George William realized that their respective partners had a past, but the longer no one mentioned it, the more it became history. As a stepfather, Washington was dutiful and engaged, especially when it came to Jackie, whom he wanted to receive the kind of classical education that he had missed. In fact, the boy was raised with all the advantages and privileges that Washington himself had been denied. His own personal servant, a private tutor who resided at Mount Vernon, the newest toys and finest clothes, all ordered from London, his own horses and hounds for fox hunting. The only item Jackie was denied was adversity, and the predictable result began to surface soon after he went to study Latin and Greek with Jonathan Boucher, first at Fredericksburg and then Annapolis. "His mind is a good deal relaxed from study," Washington admitted to Boucher, "and more than ever turned to dogs, horses, and guns." Boucher wrote back to apprise Washington that it was worse than he knew. "I must confess to you I never did in my life know a youth so exceedingly indolent or so surprisingly voluptuous. One would suppose nature had intended him for some Asiatic prince." If Jackie had been his own son, perhaps Washington would have raised him differently. But he consistently deferred to Martha on all final decisions concerning the children. He was their guardian, she was their parent. He was to provide, but not to decide. So off Jackie went to King's College, now Columbia, in New York. The College of William and Mary was not good enough for him, where he lasted only a few months. In 1773, at age 19, he announced his decision to marry Eleanor Calvert, the daughter of Benedict Calvert, a descendant of Maryland's founding family. Under prodding from Martha, Washington acquiesced, then did everything he could to establish Jackie and Nellie in proper style on one of the inherited Custis estates. Poor Jackie predictably failed at managing his plantation and died young in 1781, just when Washington was sealing American victory in the American Revolution at nearby Yorktown. Patsy's story was even sadder than Jackie's. Even as a little girl, she began to experience seizures that only worsened with time and eventually took the form of almost weekly epileptic fits. The latest London dolls and toys were ordered for her every year, along with medicinal potions, to include, a clear sign of parental desperation, a medieval iron ring with allegedly magical curative power. Even with these efforts, and despite several trips to different doctors and health spas that Washington personally supervised, nothing worked. She died suddenly after one of her seizures in 1773, at the age of 17. Washington ordered a black cape for Martha to wear in mourning for the following year. The Squire. Beyond the domestic centerpieces of Washington's world at Mount Vernon, there lay a broad spectrum of different roles and responsibilities that, taken together, allow us to conjure up several different mental pictures of the mature man in his pre-icon phase. Perhaps the most jarring picture, because it clashes so dramatically with his subsequent reputation as the epitome of public virtue, is that of the indulged Virginia gentleman for whom the phrase "pursuit of happiness" meant galloping to hounds. And the fox hunt is not just a metaphor. According to his diary, Washington spent between 2 and 5 hours a day for 49 days in 1768 on horseback pursuing the elusive fox. He also devoted considerable energy to breeding his hounds, who frequently confounded him with their ingenuity at linking up, what he called lining, with partners of their own choosing. Especially after 1765, when Lund Washington, a distant relative, assumed many of the managerial responsibilities at Mount Vernon, Washington enjoyed a great deal of leisure time. He traveled to Alexandria, Annapolis, and Williamsburg to take in the horse races. After 1768, his trips were often made in an expensive chariot, custom-made in London, with leather interiors and his personal crest emblazoned on the side. His record of card-playing expenses from 1772 to 1774 reveals that he played 25 times a year and just about broke even in his wagers. He purchased his wine, usually Madeira, by the butt, 150 gallons, and the pipe, 110 gallons. On any given day, he enjoyed the attention of two manservants, Thomas Bishop, a white servant who had been with him since the Braddock campaign, and Billy Lee, a mulatto slave who came on the scene in 1768. This picture of the provincial aristocrat at play would not be complete without noticing his clothing. His coats, shirts, pants, and shoes were all ordered from a London tailor, but they invariably did not fit. He complained that, "My clothes have never fitted me well." But the reason for the persistent problem was that the instructions he customarily gave his tailor were misleading. For example, when ordering an overcoat, he directed the tailor to make it to fit a person 6 feet high and proportionally made, and you cannot go much amiss. But Washington was at least 2 inches taller than 6 feet, and disproportionately made, with very broad shoulders and huge hips. When Charles Wilson Peale came down from Philadelphia to paint his portrait in 1772, Washington chose to wear his old military uniform from the Virginia Regiment days. Biographers have speculated that his decision to be depicted as a soldier might have been a premonition of his looming role in the American Revolution. It is also possible that he wore the only suit of clothes that fit him. The clothing scene is comical, but so is any one-dimensional picture of Washington as a laconic embodiment of Virginia's leisure class. The Peale portrait, by the way, which is generally regarded as a poor likeness, reinforces the laid-back image, paunch and all. Most of the time Washington was on horseback, he was not fox-hunting, but riding out to his farms, in effect overseeing his own overseers, offering meticulous instructions about when to harvest his tobacco crop, what fields to plant with corn and peas, how many hogs to slaughter. Or he was riding over to Truro Parish to perform his duties as a vestryman. A lukewarm Episcopalian, he never took communion, tended to talk about providence or destiny rather than God, and, was this a statement, preferred to stand rather than kneel when praying. Or he was traveling down to a session of the House of Burgesses in Williamsburg, where he served on 2 standing committees and handled most of the veterans' claims. Though his diary entries are usually devoted to the weather, when he describes which way the wind is blowing, he is not being metaphorical. They also record the busy, fully engaged life of a typical Virginia planter with multiple responsibilities to his family, neighbors, and workers. Most of those workers were African slaves. At least some recently arrived in Virginia, with distinctive tribal markings and little command of English. Later in his career, especially after his experience in the American Revolution exposed him to a broader set of opinions on the matter, Washington developed a more critical perspective on the institution of slavery. At this stage of his life, however, there is no evidence of any moral anxiety about owning other human beings. Like most Chesapeake planters, Washington talked and thought about his slaves as a species of property, very much as he described his dogs and horses. When they ran away, he posted notices for their recapture, included descriptions, which is how we know about the African markings, and if they ran away again, he sold them off. One recalcitrant slave named Tom, for example, was shipped off to the Caribbean. Washington's instructions to the ship captain described Tom as a rogue and runaway, but also as a hard worker who should fetch a decent price if kept clean and trimmed up a little when offered to sale. Washington estimated that Tom was worth one hogshead of molasses, one of rum, a barrel of limes, a pot of tamarinds, 10 pounds of sweetmeats, and a few bottles of good old spirits. His one concession to the humanity of his slave workers, an attitude shared by Jefferson and many of the wealthier Virginia planters, was that he would not sell them without their consent if it broke up families. He was also solicitous about their health, warning overseers not to overwork them in bad weather, and taking personal charge if disease broke out in the slave quarters. But even here, his motives were mixed. For if his slaves were incapacitated for an extended period, or died, it hurt the productivity of his plantation. There were trusted slaves who enjoyed considerable freedom of movement and personal discretion, like his servant Billy Lee, and a favorite messenger empowered to make minor business transactions named Mulatto Jack. But these were the exceptions. Most of the slaves who worked his farms he treated as cattle, and referred to only by their first names. His instructions concerning the criteria for purchasing new slaves expressed his detached attitude with unintended candor. "Let there be 2/3 of them males, the other 1/3 females. All of them to be straight-limbed, and in every respect strong and likely, with good teeth and good countenances, to be sufficiently provided with clothes." If his views on slavery were typical of his time and his class, there was one area in which he proved an exception to the pattern of behavior expected of a prominent Virginia gentleman. He was excessively and conspicuously assiduous in the defense of his own interests, especially when he suspected he was being cheated out of money or land. He took out an indictment against the local iron maker for fraud when he concluded, wrongly as it turned out, that the iron had been improperly weighed. He disputed the terms of a contract to purchase Clifton's Neck, one of the parcels adjoining Mount Vernon, generating a tangled legal conflict that stayed in the courts for 30 years. He accused his wine dealer of thievery for not filling one cask of Madeira to the top. Ship captains delivering his wheat and flour for sale in the Caribbean never got the price he thought he deserved. When he hired a friend, Valentine Crawford, to assist in the management of his western lands, he drafted the following instructions. "As you are now receiving my money, your time is not your own, and that every day or hour misapplied is a loss to me, do not therefore, under a belief that as a friendship has long subsisted between us, many things may be overlooked in you. I shall consider you in no other light than as a man who has engaged his time and service to conduct and manage my interest, and shall seek redress if you do not, just as soon from you as an entire stranger." Neither Jefferson nor most other members of Virginia's planter elite could have written such words, for they convey an obsessive concern with his own economic interests that no proper gentleman was supposed to feel, much less express so directly. Perhaps this is the underlying reason why Jefferson and so many other Virginia planters would die in debt, and Washington would die a very wealthy man. The picture one conjures up on the basis of this kind of evidence contrasts completely with the Peel portrait of a serenely nonchalant Virginia squire about to discard his old uniform for his riding clothes, then go off with his horses and hounds. This is not a man to the manner born, but a recently arrived aristocrat who, before he married a fortune, was accustomed to scrambling, literally dodging bullets. a man unwilling, indeed unable, to take anything for granted. It is not that he was insecure, quite the opposite, but the security he enjoyed had a sharp edge designed to clear the ground around it of any and all threats to its survival. He is the kind of man who will impose impossibly meticulous expectations on his overseers, even on his hounds, and always come away disappointed in their performance. Finally, this is the kind of man who will regard any failure to meet his exacting standards as a personal affront, and persistent failure as evidence of a conspiracy to deprive him of what is rightfully his. Pity the London merchant who has to deal with him. The Empire's Face. Washington's man in London was Robert Carey, head of Carey and Company, one of the city's largest and most successful mercantile houses. The Carey connection was another legacy of the Custis estate, since the firm had handled the business of Martha's first husband, as well as her own business during her brief time as a widow. One of Washington's earliest letters to Carey set the tone and defined the subsequent direction of the relationship. He complained about the price his first tobacco shipment received and about the multiple charges for shipping, insurance, and freight, plus Carey's own commission. This was not the kind of arrangement that Washington had expected, and from the very start he threatened to take his business elsewhere. "I shall be candid in telling you," he warned, "that duty to the charge with which I am entrusted, as well as self-interest, will incline me to abide by those who gives the greatest proof of their abilities." His reference to "the charge with which I am entrusted" did not just mean his patriarchal responsibility for Martha, Jackie, and Patsy. It also meant the Custis estate, three plantations totaling 18,000 acres spread out along the York River in the Tidewater region of Virginia, lands that were worked by more than 200, eventually nearly 300 slaves. His marriage to Martha made Washington the legal owner of one-third of these dower plantations, and his status as legal guardian of her children made him responsible for managing the other two-thirds. Mount Vernon may have been his signature statement as a new member of the planter elite, but the Custis plantations in the Tidewater, devoted almost entirely to tobacco, produced the bulk of his cash crop. And it was the size of his annual tobacco production that made him eligible for the services of Carey and Company. Smaller growers, and by the middle of the 18th century the majority of Virginia planters, sold their crops to domestic buyers and purchased most of their consumer goods locally. But the planters with the largest estates, those at the very top of the social pyramid, preferred the consignment system, whereby they consigned or entrusted sale of their crop to mercantile houses in England. At least theoretically, this arrangement assured the highest price for one's crop. But the greatest advantage of the consignment system was the access it offered to London's shops and stores. A consumer revolution was brewing in England, producing newly affordable commodities like Wedgwood china for a burgeoning middle-class market. By consigning his tobacco crop to Robert Carey, Washington was joining the elite within the Virginia elite, who could wear the latest English fashions and, in their own provincial world, consume just as conspicuously as members of polite society back at the metropolitan center of the empire in London. A letter from Washington to Carey conveys the flavor of the enterprise. "Mrs. Washington would take it as a favor if you would direct Mrs. Shelby to send her a fashionable summer cloak and hat, a black silk apron, and a pair of French bead earrings and necklace. And I should be obliged to you for sending me a dozen and a half water plates, pewter, with my crest engraved. Even more eloquent, as testimonials to the spending frenzy going on at Mount Vernon, were the invoices of goods that were boxed, crated, and shipped by Carey and Company during the early 1760s, when Washington was furnishing and embellishing the house. A veritable cascade of essentials and fineries came pouring in. Dessert glasses by the dozen, a hogskin hunting saddle, a custom-made mahogany case filled with 16 decanters, a 124-pound cheese, sterling silver knives and forks with ivory handles, satin bonnets, custard cups, snuff, felt hats, engraved stationery, wine glasses by the score, prints of fox hunts in the English countryside, even six bottles of Greenough's tincture with accompanying sponge brushes to clean Washington's notoriously bad teeth. In an average year, Washington ordered more than 300 pounds worth of goods from Carey and Company. And this did not include his expenses for new slaves and adjoining land. Modern dollar equivalencies are impossible to calculate with any precision, but a rough estimate would place his spending during 5 years in the early 1760s in the range of $2 to $3 million. Gradually, it began to dawn on Washington that he was running through his entire Custis inheritance. In 1763, he rejected a request for a loan from an old army friend, explaining that his Mount Vernon expenses had swallowed up, before I knew where I was, all the money I got by marriage, nay, more. But he was truly stunned the following year when Carey apprised him that his account was more than 1,800 pounds in arrears, a debt that was only going to increase once Carey began charging 5% interest annually on the principal. Washington was caught in the trap that was snaring so many other Virginia planters, and that Thomas Jefferson, another victim, described as the chronic condition of indebtedness, which then became hereditary from father to son for many generations, so that the planters were a species of property annexed to certain mercantile houses in London. In Jefferson's version of the sad syndrome, once a planter crossed the line, it was virtually impossible to recover. If a debt is once contracted by a farmer, it is never paid but by a sale, meaning bankruptcy proceedings. Washington's initial reaction to Carey's horrible news was the farmer's perennial lament, bad luck and bad weather. Then he began to question Carey about the tobacco market. He understood that markets fluctuated almost by definition. But why was it that swings in the market always seemed to go against his interest? And why was it that the price he received for his tobacco stayed low, while the prices he paid for Carey's shipments kept going up? He had been complaining about both the quality and the cost of the imported goods from the beginning. The linens wore out in a few months, the nails were brittle, the shoes fell apart after a few wearings, the clothes never fit. But now he accused Carey of deliberately selling him inferior goods and hiking the price by 20% because he was a mere American colonist, who presumably was too ignorant to know the difference. He also claimed that Carey and his kind sold him outdated items that could only be used by our forefathers in the days of yore, instead of the fashionable styles requested. The goods shipped to him, in short, were inferior because Carey regarded him as inferior, a provincial rube, a soft touch, another one of those vapid and vacant Virginia grandees. The more Washington thought about it, the more he concluded that no amount of diligence on his part, no spell of excellent weather, no favorable fluctuations in the tobacco market, could combine to pull him out of debt, because the mercantile system itself was a conspiracy designed to assure his dependency on the likes of Carey. When Washington thought of that abstract thing called the British Empire, he did not think politically, envisioning the Hanoverian kings and the members of Parliament. He thought economically. The face he saw was Robert Carey's, and he did not trust him. Was Washington's diagnosis of his predicament correct? As far as Robert Carey is concerned, all the evidence suggests that he was an honest merchant who provided his Virginia clients with fair market value for their tobacco, charged them appropriately for their purchases, and did not smuggle excessive charges into his invoices. What's more, historians of the planter class in Virginia have documented the inherent difficulties of growing tobacco as a cash crop. From the very origins of the colony, skeptical observers were troubled by an economy built on smoke and a plant that seemed to possess a unique capacity to deplete the fertility of the soil. More recently, economic historians have called attention to the vagaries of the tobacco market in Europe, chiefly because of Spanish production of cheap tobacco, which drove down prices. And most recently, social historians have targeted the lavish lifestyles of the Virginia planters, which combined a blissful obliviousness to the proverbial bottom line with an apparently irresistible urge to imitate the styles and consumption levels of the English gentry. On the other hand, the consignment system, by its very definition, did place Washington's economic fate entirely in Carey's hands, providing him with total control over the price Washington got for his tobacco, the cost and quality of all the goods he received in return, and the debits and credits to Washington's account, as well as the separate accounts kept for Jackie and Patsy based on their Custis inheritance. All the risks of weather, spoilage, market fluctuations, and shipping mishaps fell on Washington's side of the ledger. All the leverage lay with Carey. Every time one of the invoices from Carey and Company arrived at Mount Vernon, it served as a stark statement of Washington's dependence on invisible men in faraway places for virtually his entire way of life. If the core economic problem was tobacco, the core psychological problem was control, the highest emotional priority for Washington, which, once threatened, set off internal alarms that never stopped ringing. By sheer coincidence, in the fall of 1765, just as Washington was grappling with the bad news from Carey and his own response to it, the much-despised Stamp Act was scheduled to go into effect in Virginia. This provocative piece of legislation, Parliament's first effort to impose a direct tax on the colonies in order to help defray the costs of managing its expanding empire, generated widespread opposition throughout Virginia and all the American colonies. Washington was not an active participant in the debate, but he was a strongly supportive witness for the opposition. The Stamp Act imposed on the colonies by the Parliament of Great Britain engrosses the conversation of the speculative part of the colonists, he observed, who look upon this unconstitutional method of taxation as a doleful attack upon their liberties and loudly exclaim against the violation. But while most outspoken opponents of the Stamp Act, those whom Washington called the speculative part, emphasized the constitutional argument, his response more directly reflected his personal experience with Carey and Company. Such ill-judged measures as the Stamp Act, he suggested, were likely to have the ironic but salutary effect of reducing American dependence on British imports. And the eyes of our people, already beginning to open, will perceive that many luxuries which we lavish our substance to Great Britain for can well be dispensed with, while the necessaries of life are mostly to be had within ourselves. Others could make the legal arguments about taxation and representation. Washington's thinking, conditioned by his personal experience with the practical operation of the British Empire, moved instinctively to the much more palpable issue of economic independence. He also chose to act in a direct and personal fashion to recover his own independence from Carey and Company. Starting in 1766, he abandoned tobacco as his cash crop at Mount Vernon, one of the first of the major Virginia planters to make the change. From now on, he would grow wheat, construct his own mill to grind it into flour, and sell the flour in Alexandria and Norfolk. Nor was that all. He built his own schooner, or rather had slaves build it for him, to harvest the herring and shad of the Potomac and sell the fish locally or in the Caribbean. He eventually purchased a ship, which he christened the Farmer, to carry his flour, fish, and corn to such distant markets as Lisbon. Along the way, he developed a full-scale spinning and weaving operation at Mount Vernon to produce linen and wool fabric for workers' clothing. He was not completely free of tobacco, since it remained the chief crop in his Custis plantations. Nor was he completely free of Carey and Company, which continued to fill annual orders for Washington until 1774, though usually for smaller shipments. Despite these lingering London dependencies, his preferred course after 1765 made it quite clear that this was a man determined to defy the pattern of indebtedness that swallowed up so much of the Virginia planter class, and hell-bent on freeing himself from the clutches of Robert Carey. If only in retrospect, he was already in personal rebellion against the slavish seductions of the British Empire. Facing West. In the first renovation of Mount Vernon, completed in 1759, the main entrance was switched from the east to the west side of the mansion. There were architectural and landscaping reasons for the change, to be sure, but the symbolism of the switch, from an eastward to a westward facing, accurately expressed one of Washington's deepest convictions, namely, that the future lay in those wild and wooded lands of the Ohio country that he had explored and fought over as a young man. Gaining control of the vast American interior, after all, had been the central achievement of the French and Indian War, at least as Washington understood it. When John Posey, one of his fox-hunting companions, complained about the impoverished condition of his own debt-ridden plantation, Washington urged him to abandon his eastern prejudices and make a fresh start. "There is a large field before you," he explained, "an opening prospect in the back country for adventurers, where an enterprising man with very little money may lay the foundation of a noble estate in the new settlements upon Monongahela for himself and posterity." Even while ensconced on the eastern edge of the continent at Mount Vernon, Washington spent a good deal of his time and energy dreaming and scheming about virgin land over the western horizon. The dreaming received considerable inspiration When Washington looked out his back door at the majestic view Mount Vernon afforded of the Potomac. Though it might seem bizarre to modern students of American geography, Washington shared the 18th-century version of Potomac fever that was especially virulent among Virginians, believing that the very river that flowed past his mansion provided the most direct access to the interior waterways of North America. The illusion probably derived its credibility from the long-standing claim that the western borders of the Old Dominion extended to the Mississippi or even to the Pacific, producing a habit of mind that regarded Virginia as the gateway to the West. Washington embraced this illusion with passionate intensity. So did Jefferson. And starting in 1762, began joining and leading several organizations for improving navigation on the upstream sections of the river. The Potomac mythology stayed with him all his life. It even played a significant role in the decision to locate the national capital on the Potomac in 1790. His strenuous efforts yielded no practical results. The natural water route to the interior did not exist, and the man-made version, the Erie Canal, turned out to be in New York. But they did reveal where his thoughts were flowing. In 1763, he briefly turned his attention south to an undeveloped plot of ground rather ominously called the Dismal Swamp, which was a geological anomaly. A kind of Louisiana bayou mistakenly plopped down on the border of Virginia and North Carolina. He joined a group of 10 investors, most members of the Virginia Council or House of Burgesses, who used their influence as insiders to purchase 40,000 acres of swampland that they proposed to drain and develop. Each investor also agreed to provide 5 slaves to do the draining and dredging. As with his Potomac improvements, nothing much came of this venture, though Washington held on to his 4,000 acres until 1795. An aberration within his more enduring obsession with Western land, the story of the Dismal Swamp Company does expose his voracious appetite for acreage of any and all sorts, along with his willingness to use political connections in Williamsburg to get what he wanted. But the big prize lay over the mountains. Washington's several initiatives to acquire tracts in the Ohio country crisscrossed in dizzying patterns of speculation, and the jurisdictional problem created by border disputes between Virginia and Pennsylvania, the overlapping claims of different Indian tribes, and the shifting policies of the British government all enhanced the confusion. But at bottom lurked a basic conflict about the future of the Ohio country. Washington believed it was open to settlement. The British government believed it was closed. And the Indians believed it was theirs. In 1763, George III issued a proclamation, in effect making the enormous region from the Great Lakes to the Gulf of Mexico and the Mississippi to the western slope of the Appalachians an Indian reservation, closed to Anglo-American settlers. From the beginning, Washington regarded the proclamation as a preposterous joke. "I can never look upon that proclamation in any other light," he acknowledged, "than as a temporary expedient to quiet the minds of the Indians." He regarded the Indian tribes of the region as a series of holding companies, destined to be displaced as the growing wave of white settlers flowed over the Alleghenies. There was nothing right or wrong about this development, as he saw it. It was simply and obviously inevitable. The Indians, understandably and even justifiably, would resist. After all, they had dominated the region for several centuries. But they would lose. Not because they were wrong, but because they were, or soon would be, outnumbered. Later on, during his presidency, he would attempt to guarantee tribal control over Indian enclaves, his effort to make a moral statement amidst a relentlessly realistic diagnosis of the demographic facts. And if the strategists in London chose to block this manifest destiny, they were either stupid, not understanding what the French and Indian War had won, or sinister, plotting to reserve the bounty of the American interior for themselves, all the while confining the colonists to the Atlantic coastline. Washington's most grandiose Western venture, called the Mississippi Land Company, was launched in 1763, the very year of George III's proclamation. 50 investors requested proprietary control over 2.5 million acres on both sides of the Ohio River. In 1765, the company retained a London agent to lobby the Privy Council and Parliament on behalf of their proposal, which envisioned nothing less than the creation of a feudal kingdom in the Ohio Valley, with the settlers as serfs and the owners as lords. The British ministry not only rejected the proposal, claiming such a grant would violate treaties recently signed with the Iroquois and Cherokee, but then in 1770 approved a similar request for 2.5 million acres by a group of English investors to create a whole new colony called Vandalia in the same region. Washington wrote off his investment as a loss in 1772, eventually describing the experience as clear evidence of the British government's malignant disposition towards Americans. His singular triumph, in fact the result of multiple efforts over 13 years of complex negotiations, was largely a product of his status as a veteran of the French and Indian War. In 1754, during the darkest days of the war, Governor Dinwiddie had issued a proclamation making available 200,000 acres of bounty land on the east side of the Ohio River to Virginians who answered the call. Moreover, the infamous